Title of this afternoon's seminar is Helping Without Hurting, and subtitled Supporting Others on Their Healing Journey. An overview of the seminar is that Kirsty will be dealing with consequences of abuse and what survivors want. I will be looking at what supporters want in helping people that have survived abuse. And then, if we've got time, we might go on to some suggestions with regard to counselling survivors of abuse that might be relevant to some people here within churches or other situations, but that would be much dependent on time. And then we're going to try and leave about 10 minutes for questions at the end. I'm Neil. I've been married for 9.5 years to a survivor of abuse, and also I'm a solicitor dealing with family cases, including care and domestic violence cases, and often I come across people involved in those situations who have survived abuse. Kirsty is herself a survivor of child sexual abuse, and she's head of an online community for survivors. And she's also worked with the GB Survivors Programme for the past 3 years and was one of the founding members of that. And I'm going to hand over to her now regarding the consequences of abuse.
Thank you. I'm Kirsty. As Neil said, I'm a survivor of childhood sexual and emotional abuse, and I'm going to sort of look at this subject very much from a survivor's viewpoint. What it is we want people who are trying to be our friends, our helpers, our supporters, our counsellors, what we'd like you to know, what are the most important things, and this, so sort of brief education, if you like, in that kind of way. So one of the first things that I think it's really difficult for people maybe who haven't experienced any kind of abuse or trauma in their childhoods to get is what it's like living inside the head of an abuse survivor. And this is an overhead that's kind of sums up what's probably a fairly typical refrain, constant pattern of thought, what you will find most survivors thinking or feeling at any point during the day. And my internal dialogue for many, many years ran something like this. I'm bad, no one loves me, no one could love me, I'm completely unlovable. I'm dirty, it's my fault, I'm stupid, I should have done something, I should have told someone, I hate myself, I must be bad, I must have wanted it, I must have done something, I must be responsible, I'm being punished, I deserve to die, I don't want to be me, why did these things happen to me, I must have deserved it. And that's just a sort of 30-second fragment, so you can sort of intensify that and carry it on for at least 22 hours out of 24. And that's some sort of insight into what someone who has experienced abuse of any kind lives with. It's this all-pervading belief, if you want to say, that I'm bad. What I got this whole thing, I am bad. Anything that's happened to me, it's because I'm bad. It's because it's my fault. And getting that will help you so much in understanding your friend or the person you're trying to help who's dealing with abuse issues. Of course, if you feel that you're so terribly, terribly bad and such an awful person, you can't let anyone else see this. Because if anybody was to see quite how bad you really are, then they just wouldn't want to know you. They'd go away and you'd be left on your own. So this feeling of badness has to be covered up. It has to be hidden. And most survivors are very, very good at putting up masks of all sorts of things, of pretending that everything's fine. So often people don't even know. Many survivors are incredibly high-functioning people. But you have to find ways of coping with this badness somehow. And that can lead to, as a consequence of the trauma, the survivor also having to deal with not only the original trauma, but coping with these feelings through things like eating disorders, anorexia and bulimia, through self-injury of various forms, cutting, burning, hitting, whatever, drug or alcohol abuse. It's very, very common for survivors as a way of coping with the original event to kind of go away in your head. You just pretend you're not there. It's only happening to your body. It's not happening to you. You're somewhere else. And this is sort of a way of splitting off, of dissociating yourself from an experience that was too horrific to be born otherwise. And that can carry on. It can become almost a habit, an instinctive reaction. one of my friends used to regularly start checking in with me. Okay, how much are you actually, how here are you? Well, I'm maybe here, you've got maybe 30% of me, and that was a good day. But 70% of my mind would be off somewhere else, not really present. Perfectionism. If you feel that you're bad, then you have to cover it up, and the only way to get over the badness is to be absolutely as perfect as you can be, and to be really, really good. Survivors will have incredibly high standards for themselves. And of course, feel that anything less than perfection is just more proof of how bad and how much of a failure they are. And going with that is very black and white thinking patterns. I'm good or I'm completely rubbish. Something is fine and all right or it's a complete disaster. There's no grayscale, there's no middle. And again, if you're dealing with someone who's had these kind of traumatic experiences, you can expect you'll either be absolutely perfect and wonderful or the worst person on earth and can never be trusted again. This sort of very black and white thing is typical. And depression is also very common. If you feel that you're bad, then why should you bother to live? And those kind of thinking patterns can very, very easily lead to some kind of clinical depression. Another thing that you need to know if you're relating to or dealing with abuse survivors is what I'm tending to call, I've coined this term, hearing disorders. Eating disorders are fairly common, but survivors will often have hearing disorders in which the most innocuous comment or even nonverbal gesture, whatever, will be misinterpreted or will be even misheard. If anyone was at the seminar that Jill Wellborn and I did last year on eating disorders and self-injury, Jill Wellborn gave a classic example of a hearing disorder where she mentioned to an anorexic patient she was working with, oh, have you read this book? And what the survivor heard was, you're really stupid because you haven't read it. Yeah, and she was convinced that that's exactly what her psychiatrist had said to her. You're stupid because you've not read this. And it's almost, an unconscious reaction. If you feel, and it comes out of this belief that I'm bad, and this person must have seen it, and that's what they're saying to me. They'll also very probably assume the absolute worst motivations behind any actions. Well, they're only doing this because then they want me to owe them something, or they're only doing this because it's going to make them feel better. So if you're in a relationship of whatever sort with someone who's had a traumatic past, you're probably going to have to deal with that kind of thing. And stopping and checking in every so often is always a really good idea. What did you actually hear me say then? No, I didn't say that I thought you were worthless. and again, the survivor's thought is, well, if they really knew how bad I was, then they wouldn't want to know me. Survivors also live with what some authors have referred to as the three don'ts as a legacy of abuse. And these are the abuse survivor's version of the three commandments, if you like, which is you don't talk, you don't trust, and you don't feel. And they all are very, very directly related to whatever the original trauma was. Any survivor will have been told either directly or indirectly by the perpetrator of their abuse that you don't tell. You don't tell anyone what's happening. No one's going to believe you. So not talking about what happened becomes routine. And as you go on, that not talking extends not just to not talking about, the fact that this awful thing happened to me, but also not talking about the fact that I've had a really shitty day and I'm really upset, and not talking about the fact that what you said to me then I found really hurtful, and not talking, just not talking beyond, hi, I'm fine, yes, everything's great. Don't trust. If the people who were responsible for caring for you and looking after you, the people who you were supposed to be able to rely on, were the people who let you down and who hurt you in all kinds of ways, then it's very, very difficult to trust anyone again, with even the littlest of things. Trust becomes something that feels almost impossible, like trying to walk up a mountain. And how dare I believe that anyone would do anything for me? So even say things that everyone else takes for granted, like asking someone, would you mind getting something for me while you're at the shops? I can't do that. That's A, trusting them to do something for me, believing that they really want to do something for me, thinking that I'm actually worth doing it. No, I'll just go myself. It's okay. It's easier. And the final don't is another big one. It's don't feel. This can be partly on the physical sense related to the dissociation and the splitting off that I was talking about earlier. Many survivors report, I just left my body. I didn't feel what was happening to me. And you'll often find people who've been through a traumatic experience can be completely impervious to whether it's hot or cold outside. You know, won't know what the weather's like. They're just not in touch with their bodies. And, you know, are you cold? Are you hungry? Are you thirsty? I don't know. Because knowing those things means listening to your body. And that was one thing that was very, very hard to do when you were, if you've been through something as a child, where your body was being hurt or broken or damaged or violated. So don't feel physically, and definitely don't feel emotionally, because when you've got such a maelstrom of badness running around inside you, then that's just too scary to feel. And so cutting off from emotions is, again, something that becomes almost automatic, an automatic habit. I didn't used to be able to tell anybody what I was feeling. I spent the first 6 months when I started therapy telling my counsellor, I don't do feelings. I was convinced, I do not do feelings. They were something unfamiliar, they were scary. I didn't have a language to deal with feelings. I didn't know how to label them. I didn't know that the sort of churning in my stomach and the sort of wobbly feeling was probably what most people would call being afraid. You know, I didn't have the language to make that kind of connection. And part of the sort of healing and recovery journey is learning how to do that again, learning how to let yourself get vulnerable enough to feel. But especially at the beginning, if it's someone who's maybe just starting to admit to themselves and has maybe just said to you, look, this stuff happened to me in my past and it wasn't very nice and I don't know quite what to do with it, you're going to have these sort of fairly major obstacles to deal with and to get over. And Neil is going to talk more about what that's like from a helper's and a partner's point of view. But I was trying to come up with sort of, well, what do us survivors want? You know, what are the things that can be really helpful? And I wanted things that don't have to be done by people with professional training or qualifications. I mean, therapy and counselling is probably fairly essential in helping someone heal from past trauma. But there's all kinds of ways that can be done. And we've got an exhibition upstairs outside of Hatton's Grace, more about that. But this is for anyone, if it's your mate or your partner or whoever. They tie in with those three commandments. So a safe place where we can talk. If someone does disclose to you that they've had, you know, I'm using the phrase survivor here because it's a convenient shorthand, but it's, you know, they are a person who has been through some kind of traumatic event in their past of whatever type. The first thing to do is not to panic. I mean, it's taken that person a tremendous amount of guts to actually dare to broach the subject with you, probably. And I can guarantee that they will be fixated and watching your face and watching your body language for anything that they can interpret as, that's it, they've rejected me, they don't want to know me, it's because I'm too much, it's because I'm absolutely bad, so that I can never speak to this person again, I'll just go away and hide somewhere. So be honest about your reactions. This has come as a bit of a shock. Actually saying it will mean that they don't start interpreting it as a rejection. And being able to tell your story, to be able to tell what's happened to you, is, I've found for me, and I think other survivors who I've talked to, other people who I know, have also found it an absolutely critical part. And it's not just a one-off thing, you know. I had an experience with when the first person, the first sort of pastor, leader of the house group church that I was going to at the time, with my boyfriend's encouragement, I told him I was a bit, just in very bare outlines, that I'd been sexually abused when I was a child, and I was just remembering this and found it hard to deal with. And his words to me were, well, that's been like a little dark box in the back of your head, And now you've opened that box, and we'll pray and let Jesus in, and then the box can be closed and you never have to think about it again. And I think that that attitude set me up for the next 5 years of depression, suicide, self-injury, eating disorders, and everything that spiraled down from there, because I thought, well, that's it. Obviously, I should be. I've said it now. I've told, so that should be it. And it's not. And someone may need to tell their story in different ways, at different levels, from different places inside of them, from different aspects, over and over again. And so be prepared for that. There is an if on the overhead. It's an if you're able to listen. Because some of the stories that people have to share aren't nice listening. They're not pretty. And the person doesn't tell them necessarily in a nice, this is the beginning and this is the middle and here's the happy ending kind of way. Because it doesn't work like that. If you don't feel that you're able to hear, if you're finding it too upsetting, if it's beginning to stir up your own things for you maybe, then please tell us. You know, again, it goes with this sort of hypersensitivity and this hyper-awareness that most survivors have to reading other people's reactions. We'll know, and we'll take it as being our fault. And to be able to say, actually, you know, that's kind of a bit, I'm not in a place where I can do intense stuff tonight. Why don't, you know, did you see such and such on television last night? And sometimes that's fine. You know, it can be absolutely fine, especially if it's sort of, you know, someone who's your friend or someone who's your partner. It doesn't have to become sort of the whole thing. But so that if is very important. The next safe place is a safe place where we can begin to try out this scary and unfamiliar concept called trust. And what that means from our friends, from our partners, from anyone who's trying to be in some kind of counselling relationship is an absolute bedrock of consistency. Promising that you'll do something and then not being able to do it can undo weeks, if not months, of really helpful relationship, friendship type stuff. Because, again, the survivor will assume, well, that's it. It's because I'm too much for them. It's because I'm bad. They've seen the real me now. I've shown them all of this. They've obviously gotten whatever they wanted from this, and now they don't want me anymore. So if you're saying that you'll do anything, be really sure that you can do it. You know, sort of acts of God and major disasters aside. I told someone who was trying to sort of keep a dialogue going with the survivor, look, think of what you feel you can give and then promise half that. So you know it's not going to be too much for you, but it's something then that this person can absolutely faithfully know that is going to be there. But having something that is consistent and that is there is a huge, huge beginning place in being able to know, well, yeah, maybe, just maybe this isn't going to go away. Just maybe this isn't going to turn bad like all the other stuff did. It's one of the very strong points, I think, of any kind of counselling, therapeutic-type relationship. You know, I know that on Wednesday afternoons at 3:15, my therapist is going to be there waiting for me, unless she's on holiday, which she tells me 3 weeks in advance. You know, and I can rely on that. And I don't now think, oh, but what if she's not in this week when I ring the doorbell? I did for a very long time. Each week I'd say, often she's not going to be in, and if she, you know, 3 seconds, 4 seconds, I'm waiting for her to get to the door, she's not going to be here this time, that's it, she'll have left me. But gradually over the years I've been able to trust that, because she has always been there, and that consistency is essential. I think Neil's going to touch a bit more about boundaries as well, and this again links back to the if you're able to. Very often as when a child's abused, their boundaries get completely violated. Not just the physical boundaries of their body, but the emotional boundaries of any relationship. Someone else comes in and asserts their power over them. And so very few people who've been through any kind of bad abuse experience in their childhood are any good at keeping boundaries. We'll let people write in and tell absolutely everything, or we'll keep everything walled up even with the people we're closest to. So having and we will push ourselves and overcommit ourselves and say, yeah, I can do this and this and this and this and this, or we'll refuse to do anything. And it's exactly the same thing. It's a boundary. It's knowing our own limits. It's knowing what we can and can't do. So having a friend or someone who'll model those kind of things, you know, I can, you know, okay, I can spend, you know, I've got a couple of hours now, but then we're going to have to leave it and go, or, you know, then I need to go out, or then I need to go make a phone call. And sticking, when it comes to the couple of hours, look, you know, I said I needed to go now, and going can be really helpful, even if the person is in, you know, a fairly intense state, but knowing that those boundaries, oh, yeah, oh, gosh, that person's doing something that's, I guess, taking care of themselves. You know, there's a novelty. And again, that can be helpful. The other absolute bedrock cornerstone of trust is confidentiality. And I think this applies on whatever level. Even if it's a friend of yours, don't go telling anyone else without their permission, without checking with them first. Not even the barest facts. Don't even go saying, well, I was seeing someone for, you know, just for prayer. You know, it's very easy in some Christian circles for prayer requests to become a way of confidentiality being breached. And again, when a child is abused, then their own rights and their own sense of self gets taken away, and someone else taking what you've said and your own words and your own story and spreading it around without your consent or your knowledge is very scary and makes it impossible to trust. And even on a professional level, you know, if you feel like you have to, if you're in a prayer ministry type situation and someone discloses something and you're obligated to tell the church leadership, then tell the survivor, possibly even tell them before. Look, if I hear anything, I am obliged under my own, you know, my guidelines to tell this person. What would you like me to tell them? Can I tell them your name? Can I tell them your situation? What information do you feel comfortable with me giving out? So, and then stick to that. And of course, anyone working in a professional therapeutic type relationship will have very strict professional guidelines on confidentiality. And finally, a safe place to feel. People who've been through bad experiences are often terrified of emotions, if that's not a sort of contradiction in terms. But they wouldn't say they were terrified, they just, you know. particularly these difficult ones like feeling anger. And seeing somebody, you know, the first time I saw a friend of mine get absolutely furious and have a huge hissy fit and throw things, something that her mother had said, I was cowering in a corner, too afraid to look up and see what was going on, but knowing that she was able to do that and express those feelings, and she was okay afterwards, and her mother was okay afterwards, and they ended up talking about the situation, and a lot of the tension was resolved. So again, there's other. It was someone showing to me there are other ways of dealing with this sort of feeling when you're angry at somebody, than taking it all in on yourself or hurting yourself or whatever other ways survivors might use to cope with anger. And this is the next point is kind of a balance to the whole black and white thing. To say that, well, it's okay to have often contradictory feelings at the same time. You can love someone and be furious with them, and one doesn't cancel out the other. You can like someone in this regard, but not trust them with this thing. That things don't have to be all or nothing. That emotions don't have to be just one single channel. That we're very complex and amazing individuals with feelings that reflect that. And if a person feels accepted, then it can help them begin to accept themselves. And sometimes, this is all sounding very, very intense and very therapy type stuff, but sometimes just a safe place to be is all that is needed. One of my absolute lifelines when I was beginning to deal with a lot of the abuse-related memories and feelings were a couple, a young married couple from the church I was at, who made a regular date with me and said, look, Friday night, why don't you come over, we'll get in pizza and we'll watch a video. And knowing that I had something to do that was completely non-related to what I was doing, all the stuff that was going on, and I could just chill out and be, and let them see, and they saw me as me, as a person. Yes, a person who was struggling with some very difficult feelings and memories and issues, but they kind of encouraged me to be someone who could relax and just, you know, chill out as well. And having a social space where you can go where, and you know, they knew. And they knew that if I wasn't feeling like talking, then they wouldn't make me talk. We'd just stick the video on and watch a film and maybe make some conversation afterwards about what it was like. But having that as a safe place was that I knew I could go to, and I didn't have to talk about intense stuff but it was there for me, was also a real lifesaver. So if it's your friend and you feel, well, I can't do any of this stuff, just saying, look, how do you fancy coming out to the cinema? Or why don't we go out to hear this band tonight? Can be more helpful for them than you could ever imagine. Because it's a little bit of normality when you're dealing with stuff that's turning your whole world upside down. And on that, I'm going to hand back over to Neil, who's going to talk about the sort of the other side of these kind of relationships. Thank you.
When we were looking at this seminar today and thinking what might be useful, we thought that it might be useful to have someone who is actually a partner and a friend of someone who has survived abuse. And so what I'm going to talk about briefly is just some of my own experiences, and I hope that that will be helpful for you. As I said earlier, I've been married to Concetta for 9.5 years, and she's given me some permission today just to share some of her and our experiences. Ours was what you might call a whirlwind romance. We went out in the September, engaged in the October, and were married in the March. So we were fairly hitched quickly. And whilst I was aware of some of her childhood experiences, I can honestly say I was not prepared for the impact and effect of those experiences on her, but also on what was to be our relationship and marriage. In reality, I didn't know what I was letting myself in for. How can you be prepared for living someone who goes through periods of numbness, of deep depression, of tears, of anger, of intense pain, just sheer intensity of feelings, frustration, aggression? I mean, the list can be endless. And for the first 7 years of our marriage, I wouldn't know what I was coming home to of a given evening. At times, I was scared that she might just end it all and might just end her life. There were times I would come home and find her curled up under a table or under her computer, in her office. At times, I would have to experience her anger being occasionally directed at herself. And in effect, that her survival of abuse was a cloud causing a big shadow, but not only covered and penetrated every aspect of her life, but was big enough to invade and take over our lives and my life. So what can you expect? And we've just put up a list there of some of the things that I've felt: isolation, feeling useless and out of my depth, anxiety, frustration, helplessness, feeling attacked at times because I didn't understand or I didn't know how to respond, feeling anger and confusion and not being able to understand. And the question, I suppose, I've asked myself when preparing for this seminar is, how do you help someone who often cannot communicate what's going on inside, other than in ways that seem intense in the extreme, are potentially harmful and involve issues that can be completely remote to your own experience of childhood and love? Is it any surprising that we feel isolated or frustrated, that we confuse our friend's partner's anger as an attack on us, that we feel useless and out of our depth, not being able to understand, and in our anxiety that we get angry at the situation we find ourselves in? If it's any consolation to those of you who have experienced those feelings, you're not alone. It struck me that those feelings aren't actually too dissimilar to those felt by survivors themselves. And I realised about 18 months ago that by default, I had become a survivor too. And in fact, I only learnt this morning that there is actually a label for this, and that's secondary traumatisation. So what do you need? And there's some... I apologise for that overhead, but unfortunately that one we forgot to print out, so we've had to do that by hand. But I hope you can see the headlines there. Understanding and knowledge. This is one of the key things. If you have been to any of the seminars we've had so far for survivors of abuse, you'll know that one of the key things that are repeated is that education for survivors is the first step to empowerment. And so if that's true for survivors, then to become part of that empowering process, which we are as friends and partners, we need to increase our understanding and knowledge of the issues surrounding abuse. And there are three main sources. There are our partners and friends that we're supporting. They have a wealth of experience. They might not always understand what's been going on in their own lives, but the more that they open up and talk to us, then you gain a wealth of knowledge and understanding from them. There are books and resources, and we have an acetate with some of the books and resources. And we also have a list of books and resources, not only for survivors, but also partners of survivors. And I would just highlight a couple there. Courage to Heal is a good general book, and Allies in Healing, which has a number of chapters which pose questions if you're feeling, I feel isolated, I feel helpless, I don't understand. And they have some good examples and just other people's feedback on where they were at in that situation and what helped them to work things out. And there's Ghosts in the Bedroom as well, Ken Graber's book. Another source to help us understand, to grow in our knowledge, is others, support groups. I mean, I'd like to acknowledge here Greenbelt for they're giving space to the Survivors Program. This started 3 years ago, and slowly but surely they've given space with the room up in Hatton's Grace, and 7 to 9 each evening of Greenbelt, there's a closed session for survivors of abuse where there's a safe space there for people to share their experiences and to hopefully move on in their journey of healing. There's also a website and a survivors based email network, and there's also the web we'll put that up again at the end, but there's also Kirsty's helpful site, which is www.stardrift.net/survivor. And there's some useful things, not only for survivors, but also some of the stuff that she's talked about today that you can access if you're a partner or a friend of a survivor. Another key area is support for you. The expectation upon me from Conchetta was that I had to be all things to her. I had to be a husband, a lover, a father, a counsellor, a best friend. I mean, the list could go on, and I just couldn't do that. I tried, and I often failed. And whilst the pace of change, the pace of the journey has to be the survivor's, you can choose yourself to be supported. And I would say my greatest regret on our journey, for at least for the first 7 or 8 years, is that I held it all in, that I tried to cope with this all within my own inner strength and didn't feel able to share and wasn't aware, to be honest with you, of the resources that are out there now for helpers and partners and friends of survivors. And so I would urge anyone that is a friend or a partner to get support. There are plenty of groups out there. There's a new scheme that Greenbelt has used some of the monies from last year's communion, which I think is mainly for survivors, but it may well be that they'll move that out to also partners and friends of survivors. There are support groups out there, and if you access the website, then I'm sure that if you're interested, we can direct you to those things or help you set something up if you feel that's appropriate. What I would say, that, as Kirsty said earlier, is that if you do get support, respect the confidentiality of your partner, of your friend, And maybe speak and talk through with them the boundaries of any help that you get. It's your time, it's your help, but you also need to be wary of what you are sharing of their experience and that's within acceptable bounds to them. But what I would say is getting support is not a betrayal. I think I live with this thing that if I went and tried to get help for myself, then I might divulge something or I might be seen to not have the strength that Conchetta needed of me, but it's not a betrayal. It's an essential thing that we get support. And similarly, we need to make our own space and time. I can honestly say that most probably the first 6 or 7 years of our marriage, I felt a lot of the time that I was handcuffed Concetta had this intense fear of my dying. And it meant that she was quite a close watcher of my time and a keeper of my time. So if I was going out somewhere, I always had to give a time when I was going to come back. And if I was late by 10 or 15 minutes, then it was a mini crisis. And a lot of the decisions that we made within the first 7 years of our marriage were pretty much on the basis of what would be best for Concetta. And I don't think I ever communicated that, but always in the back of my mind, it wasn't really, well, what would I want? Or, you know, even holidays or things like that. Often it would be, well, you know, what would be best for her and her journey? And it kind of sucks you in to the trauma, and it makes that trauma not just the survivor's trauma, but it sucks your relationship and it sucks your marriage into that. And with hindsight, I wish I'd made some more time for myself, you know, pursued a hobby or just had that little bit of time where I could say this is my own and I could just almost re-energize myself and rebuild that inner strength in order to help me cope with that aspect of our marriage. And one of the hardest challenges, I think, is making and setting boundaries for both of you. So not just your own boundaries, your own space, and the survivor obviously needs their own boundaries to feel secure and to begin to trust you. But boundaries, if in your relationship, whether you're a partner with someone or whether you're a friend. And I remember before we were married, whilst it was only a short period of time before going out and getting married, we agreed this thing that only one night a week would we either discuss the wedding, either between ourselves or with others, or we make the plans. And believe me or not, you can arrange a wedding one night a week within a matter of 4 or 5 months. And it was great because it took the pressure off. We didn't have to talk wedding all the time. And it was just a great boundary that we set that we could work. And whilst I appreciate that the issues surrounding abuse is not as compact and neat as that, and life gets messy and these issues can just rise up at any time, boundaries are important, and you are able to set them. And I think that if we'd agreed and set boundaries around things like relating to Concetta's family, if we were able to set boundaries rather than being just drawn along with these things and not always being aware of how that might affect us as a couple or how that might knock us back in our journey, then I think we would have reduced some of the incidences of pain and heartache that we had over that time. And the same with friendship relationships. Kirsty said earlier, don't be afraid to say, well, I've got a couple of hours, but I need to move on or, you know, go and do something else or whatever it is. Setting boundaries and ensuring that there's that mutuality of relationship as well, that it doesn't become so one-sided that it makes it, A, very hard for you, but also it's modelling an unhealthy balance to relationships generally. But having said that, the reality is that it's hard to live up to what is required of us in any given relationship. So don't be daunted by this. I've made mistakes, and yet we've been able to move on in our journey together. And I would say that for me, going it alone, and I certainly don't recommend that, is that the three pillars for support that I had were hope, love, and commitment. And I can honestly say that I never doubted for one moment that Concetta and I would come to a place where the trauma would not dominate our lives and that the effects of it would not be integrated as a healthy part of our everyday being and lives. The reality is you don't wipe away the trauma. You don't wipe away the effects of abuse. That's very much an integral part of who a survivor is and their relationships. That will always be there. But I never doubted for one moment. Sorry. Well, you're entitled to that opinion. Love and commitment. There's a debate as to whether love sustains commitment or commitment sustains love. And I'm a great believer that the two go hand in hand. And that one at times needs to pull the other to keep up. That sometimes it's your love that helps you to keep committed, but at other times it's your commitment to the other person that reinforces and brings out the love again. But they go hand in hand, and alongside hope, love and commitment are very, very important. And Kirsty has stressed the need for commitment in any relationships. Now, bearing in mind that I'm talking about supporters of survivors of abuse, what can you gain? And again, this is not about what you get out of a relationship before you go into it, but it's about, as having been a supporter and a survivor of a survivor, it's the things that you can benefit in your life, having started on that journey. The privilege of sharing in someone's pain and suffering, and I've never said this to Concetta, and I'll say it now, but whilst it's been hard and we've had some tough years, it's been a privilege being married to you. And if I had not been married to you, I don't think I would have ever known what it is to love someone or what it is to be committed to someone, and I thank you for that. And I've gained a greater understanding of myself. It has been tough, and I've learnt things about myself that I've not liked, and I've had to work through that. But I've also gained a strength that comes from someone else's courage to heal. And the reality is, it's all Concetta's courage. It's not mine, it's hers. And I've gained the strength from being part of that. And I've also gained a realization that healing happens, that hope is not false, it's not blind, it happens. And in her life, and in who she is and what she's become and where she's going to go, I've really learnt the real fruits of hope, love and commitment. And it's a journey worth travelling.
Thank you, Neil. I want to whiz through a few very, very quick do's and don'ts for anyone who is in any sort of counselling type relationship with someone who's experienced abuse or trauma, particularly if you're working with them within a church setting, because, you know, as the work we've been doing here with the Greenbelt Survivors group has started hearing other people's stories, there is still an awful lot of, I guess, just not knowing or not understanding and wanting to help, but inadvertently doing something that just makes matters worse. So this is I'll do a very quick whiz through this. It could be a whole other hour and a half in itself, but we'll keep this quickly. So particularly if you're doing any kind of prayer ministry or Christian-based counselling, don't offer quick fixes from Jesus. The minister who said to me, "That's it, it's in a little box, you've let Jesus in, it'll all be all right now." And it wasn't. And I don't want to say that I'm limiting God's power to heal, because I certainly don't intend, you know, I don't do that. And you know, God is sovereign and can do whatever God wants to do. But I know very few survivors who've ever experienced an instant zap kind of healing. It doesn't tend to work that way. Healing and recovery from abuse is a very slow, at times, journey. That happens sort of little step by little step and in little bits. And I know many survivors who felt incredible guilt from the church because they've not been healed, because they've gone forward for prayer ministry and they've gone forward for more prayer ministry and they've gone forward for more and more prayer ministry and they've been counselled. You know, I went through the counselling from my house group leaders. I went to counselling from the pastoral team. I then went to counselling from the church eldership team. And it felt like then I kind of reached a point where they just didn't know what to do with me, because I'd been through sort of all three levels of the counselling and I was still depressed. I was still self-injuring. I still had flashbacks. I was still having memories. And I ended up feeling like that was my fault. Like there was something, this was more proof that I was bad, that God just didn't want to heal me. And starting any kind of prayer and prayer work with a survivor from an assumption and a place that this is a slow journey, this is going to happen in little bits, this is going to happen over probably many years, because you've lived with this for lots of years. This didn't happen to you overnight, it's not going to get fixed overnight. starting from that point of view will make things an awful lot easier and less pressurized for the survivor. And I know it can be really difficult, especially when you're wanting to help them and wanting to see results. And that kind of leads on to, do commit yourself that this is probably, if you're going to get involved in some kind of counseling type relationship with the survivor, you're looking at a long-term thing. You are looking at years rather than months. And if you don't feel you can make that commitment, then either be very clear about that or don't start out on the journey with them. If you feel out of your depth, then say so. If, you know, survivors can often have all kinds of complex needs. I touched on this at the beginning, stuff, eating disorders, self-injury, dissociation, depersonalization, the clinical depression, all kinds of stuff. And if that's something that you don't know about, then help them find someone who does know. Encourage them to get, you know, quote, secular counseling, whether if they can find someone who is experienced and used to working with abuse survivors. Encourage them to talk to their doctor about, you know, if they feel that medication, or you decide together that medication might be appropriate, then do that. And to echo what Neil said, do get support for yourself too, because it can be very emotionally draining listening to someone's past trauma. A few more do's. Do remember that each person's journey in their healing is different. So just because you used a certain prayer formula or a certain visualization exercise or a certain, you know, certain Bible verse helped one person, it's not going to help somebody else necessarily. Their issues and their stuff may be completely different. So it's not, don't try a one, it's not a one, you know, one solution fits all kind of thing. One thing that I found immensely helpful was finding out how you can still relate to God from a dark place, because the survivor's going to go through really dark places. So a place when they're feeling despair, anger, and loss, to be able to find God in those places. And I know in some church cultures, including a church culture I spent some time with, that really wasn't, you know, Christians were meant to be full of the joy of the Lord and the strength of the Lord and really happy and joyful and bubbly. And when you're not there, then that can just leave you feeling like God's a million miles away. So a leader or therapist or somebody from church who can encourage you to find God in the darkness, again, that can be of value that's beyond words. And reiterating one more time, because it's so essential, please do keep everything confidential. Whatever the structure is of your ministry team or your prayer team, in this, the work that you're doing with a survivor, they have to feel that what they tell you is only going as far as you and God, unless you have their explicit permission to share things. There are some very big issues, again, so bringing on these with sort of 2 minutes before we reach time for questions. This is forgiveness. It's a nice, pat, easy Christian thing to say, oh, well, you need to forgive your abusers. You need to forgive the people who hurt you. And I think, as Concetta, was it you who used the alphabet analogy in the survivors group? When you're healing from abuse or trauma, it's like, you know, you're starting off at letter A, and forgiveness is kind of letter, you know, L, M, N, sort of way down the line. And the survivor needs to be able to get angry about what was done, about the injustice and the violence and the violation that happened. And, you know, There's a Bible verse about, well, you know, God loves justice and mercy, and that's what God's about. And that has to come before you can get to a place of forgiveness. There are an awful lot of people I've heard who felt so angry and have walked away from the church because all they were told was, well, you've just got to forgive, and you're not healed and you're not recovered because you haven't forgiven. And depending on who you talk to, I know some survivors who say they've not forgiven their abusers for what they did. They're never going to say it's okay, because it isn't okay. You can't ever say that violating a child is okay. A person may get to a point where they say, "Well, I'll leave this person up to God to deal with. I'm not going to let what they did to me affect the rest of my life." But please don't push forgiveness on us. Particularly if the person has been abused by someone who is in a parental, father-related place in their life, then God as Father can be awful. Someone says, "Father God," the image that comes into your head is a person coming at you with a stick to beat you into a pulp. That's really not going to help prayer. I know there are other survivors who have found the ability to take God's fatherhood as being something completely separate from the fathering they experienced and to gain real healing from that. But this comes back to the please don't assume. And until you know where that person's at with their images of parenthood and fathering, then play it safe and steer clear from them. You know, starting off a prayer with Father God, you could have lost them instantly in those two words. So please be wary and be aware of that. And also be aware of the power dynamics. It's ever so easy in a sort of Christian counselling type relationship for you to be seen as the person who comes in and has all the answers. And the survivor sits there and gets prayed for and gets, you know, takes in the words and then has to do the getting better bit. And actually, I mean, Neil touched on this when he said the best source of understanding what's going on is from the survivor themselves. And the survivor, on some level, I think, can know that this is, you know, they need to feel that they're in control of the process and of what's happening to them. Because that's then so different from the past where they were not in control and where control was forcibly taken from them. And finally, a sort of message to end on, there is hope and healing does happen. And I'm here 10, 15 years on from that first experience at a much different place in my life and one where I'm feeling an awful lot better about myself and learning to like and accept myself and accept and receive God's love and the love and care of my friends and my support people around me. And healing does happen. And as Neil said, being able to be part of that, whether as a therapist, a counsellor, whether as a friend or whether as a partner, is an incredible experience. I know I couldn't have made it this far without people around me. And you can be a part of that healing for anyone you know who's been through a kind of abuse, trauma. So thank you very much. Thank you for listening. And we'll stick the resource sheet up at the moment. We do have a slightly extended version of that list. We've got some paper copies of that on the side over there. There's also some leaflets about the Survivors Programme of seminars and groups and workshops that we're running at this year's festival. There's still, you know, a couple more events and seminars taking place throughout the weekend. Jane Chavroux speaking in Hatton's Grace tomorrow from 11 to 12 p.m. on God as abuser and self-harmer and how the theology that we have about God affects these kind of issues raised in the church. There's a workshop this afternoon with some art and therapy taster sessions with looking at the role of art in healing and therapy and the chance to try out and explore drama therapy and art therapy, journaling and prayer movement. And then on Monday, a panel group about group therapy and survivors groups and how that can work. So there's these little programs that have all the details of that on the side. There's little leaflets with details about the email group for survivors here at Greenbelt that's been set up. And I'll shut up now, and I think Neil and I can take if anyone's got any questions. So thank you.
10 minutes.
10 minutes for questions. Okay. Okay.
Hi. I just wondered whether the term had ever been used to either of you in discussion, and has anyone actually said to you, well, sort of put your hand up, oh, you're very, very strong. And then how did that make you feel? Because I've heard that said several times. And I just wondered how that sort of made you feel. Does it make you feel strong? Does it actually make you feel like it's a way of them to shoot it? Because I don't really want to go any further. It's a way of sort of closing the conversation.
Yeah. Did everyone hear that or not? Okay. She asked how if either of us had experienced somebody sort of putting their hand on the shoulder and saying, "But you're so strong," you know, and how that can leave the survivor feeling. Firstly, I didn't raise this issue, but touch can just be hugely triggery. So someone, particularly someone who I don't maybe know that well, coming up and putting their hand on my shoulder, again, it can. Even that said, be careful with touch and with placement, because if someone had been repeatedly hit or grabbed at a particular place in their body, that can be very, very upsetting for them. And those kind of things, again, it's my immediate reaction is, don't you dare presume to know how I feel, you know? And most survivors do not feel strong. We do not feel brave. We do not feel like we're incredible people for having gone through this, because most of us are just feel like we're barely scraping through and struggling so hard to take each breath and to stay alive. And I think honour the pain. And if And be honest about why you want to say that. Or rephrase it, you know, I see you as being incredibly strong. From my point of view, this is how you appear. You know, give that distance, acknowledge that, but don't presume to know how that feels. Does that resonate? Yeah, it's sort of the put it back in the box kind of thing. Yeah.
Why do survivors sometimes choose, like, the average normal people to talk to? Why I don't sometimes comprehend why someone would want to share all that with me? As a kind of, someone has not been through that anymore. Mm-hmm.
So the question is, why would an abuser sort of share... Why would a survivor share some of their life with just an ordinary person, as it were?
I can give... this is speaking from my own experience. The people I chose to tell, they were friends, they were people that I trusted, they were people that I thought wouldn't freak out, they were people that I felt I could let a little bit of the mask down with, people I felt safe with. So, you know, they may not have felt it at the time, but it was actually a really good thing that they were the people that I'd chosen. They were maybe people I thought might know something about it themselves or would be willing to learn, and people I felt, I believed wouldn't go away, or at least I really, really hoped wouldn't go away. There were some people I told where I felt I told because I had to, like the leader of the church, for instance. That wasn't my choice to disclose to them. That was me telling because I was told that I ought to, and I wanted to be good, so I did. So there's sort of the two levels.
That question for me kind of ties in with the thing about the strong. There is nothing extraordinary about pretty much anyone in this room. We're all pretty... ordinary. I might not be the same person I was 7 or 9 years ago, and maybe Concetta feels there was something special about me, but I'm just an ordinary person who had a situation that you know, you deal with, and everyone here has the capacity to love and to provide the commitment that's needed, and everyone has the ability to hope, and that's really all that's required. You know, you find that the resources and the strength suddenly just comes from somewhere because of your commitment and your love. So there's nothing extraordinary about us, really.
Mark, did you?
I'd like to say being a survivor, which, like you were speaking over there, with what you said, Mark, basically, people that haven't survived don't understand the ground that we fought on. It's not like these Christians in here who've been brought up as a Christian all their life, they don't see what a survivor will see. You know, they don't feel how a survivor feels. I mean, I find it hard to breathe at times because...
Is it working?
Yeah.
My church will see me now, they take it all off, you know, I've got a microphone. But, like, I find it hard to breathe at times, you know, because I feel like the air's stale, you know. And all I can remember is what I survived through, what I went through. And people, you could be talking to people who put in, I'm sorry, but I feel sorry for you if you don't understand that. I mean, I can't expect everyone to understand it. But it's all I can talk about because it's all I've seen, it's all I've been brought up with. It's all, you know, I go to sleep, I see it in my dreams. You know, I think this man's amazing to stay with someone for as long as he did, who survived. You know, I think he deserves a round of applause. Because, I'll be honest with you, if someone's crying, I mean, I cry. It's hard to say, Kim, why are they crying? And it's hard to go up to them and say, why are you crying? Because, you know, if you get to the point when they're telling you, you're just going to end up not knowing, the survivor will blow your mind. You have to be mind strong to be with a survivor. You know? I mean, it's like, I wanted someone from my church to come here today. Just to, you know, because it's about helping the survivor, isn't it? And they've all thought, well, we'll go here, we'll go there. No one's thought of saying, tell you what, Mark, we've known you for so long, we'll give you an hour of our time and come here. You know? But I can accept that because they're human beings. You know, we're not perfect. Just some of us find it hard to breathe. But we'll carry on breathing because one day the survivor is going to live.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And that's it.
Women in green, yeah. Oh, absolutely. I'm sorry if I didn't make that point clearly. Forgiveness is not the same as saying, you know, abuse is okay. You can forgive and what happened was never okay. Abuse is never okay, but that doesn't mean... Yet so often we have this idea of forgiveness as being sort of a covering everything over and say, well, that's what, it's all right, it doesn't matter. And forgiveness isn't that at all. And I'll underline that 5 times. Okay. How are we doing for time? Okay. Right, I know. I can see there are questions. I can certainly hang around and talk to people afterwards. Do use some of the resources. If you are a survivor, there you go. Panel at 4:30 at Grit tomorrow. Lots and lots of questions and answers, and more time to talk. Come and take the sheets here. If you are a survivor and want to come to the closed group, 7:00 in Hatton's Grace, which is up on the 4th floor. Here tonight, and thank you for listening.